So I'm an observer, and I work on a lot of different aspects related to star formation and the molecular gas that the stars form out of, but my first and continuing love is working on nearby galaxies. And so although I've had students and done quite a lot of work with my students on galactic star formation, and so I may contribute to some of the discussions in that area later on in the week, what I wanted to tell you about today was the work that I did during my sabbatical at the SMA in Hilo, Hawaii. We just got back from sabbatical just about a year ago this week. And while I was there, I was able to lead a large, what's called a legacy project with the SMA, to look at a moderately large sample of nearby luminous and ultra-luminous infrared galaxies, leading this team of people listed here. And so what I'm going to do in my talk today, just to give you a very brief reminder of what luminous infrared galaxies are, what a few of their key properties are. I'm then going to describe our legacy project, basically the galaxies involved and what our scientific goals are, and a little bit on the technical details of it. And then I'm going to give you some first science results on the survey, some measurements we've been able to do on the gas to dust ratio using these data, and also comparing these galaxies to the high redshift submillimeter galaxies, which have been discovered over the last decade using bolometer arrays like SCUBA and MAMBO, and which have really opened up a new window to star formation in the early universe for us. And in this section, I've added a little bit specifically tailored to this conference, a few of the key properties of the galaxies, like gas surface densities, gas volume densities, star formation rates, and so on. And then I'll close. I have a couple slides on future work and prospects, and if I run out of time, then we won't get to that, and that won't be so bad. Okay. So ultra-luminous infrared galaxies are in general, galaxy mergers. When you look at galaxies with far-infrared luminosities above 5 times 10 to the 11th solar masses, solar luminosities, you find that they're all interacting galaxies or close pairs. And this has been known since very early after they were discovered as a class with IRAS in the early 80s. This shows you some nice Hubble Space Telescope images from a paper by Nick Scoville taken in the near-infrared. Actually, the only one of these galaxies that is in my sample today is Markarian 273. But you can see tidal tails, double nuclei. These little compact sources are massive star clusters. So just to put these galaxies in perspective across their whole spectral energy distribution, the ultra-luminous infrared galaxies in the starburst put out most of their radiation in the mid to far infrared, and then down here are a couple examples of more normal galaxies, a disk galaxy and an elliptical galaxy, still with a bump in the infrared, but no longer dominating the energy output. So from the very early days, a key question was, what was the source of the energy in these ultra-luminous infrared galaxies? And people quickly settled on two main possibilities, which were a compact starburst or an active galactic nucleus. And the debate raged on for probably 10 to 15 years, I think, really until we started to have very good mid-infrared data on these galaxies from the ISO satellite. And Spitzer has been contributing a lot here as well, although I'm not yet up to speed on everything that's been done with Spitzer on these galaxies. The reason you needed to go to the mid-infrared, as you'll see later in my talk, is that the visual extinctions towards the centers of these galaxies are huge. They're, you know, tens to hundreds of magnitudes of visual extinction based on the dust and gas masses. And so you just really can't go in and see what's looking until you get out to the mid-infrared, where your extinctions are equivalently maybe 5 to 10 magnitudes. So this is some work from Reinhard Genzel, who has either been here or will be here. This is plotting different diagnostics from the mid-infrared. On the vertical axis, we have forbidden lines, oxygen 4 over neon 2 or oxygen 2 over a sulfur 3 line. And this is a measure of the hardness of the radiation. So the more up this way you go, the harder your radiation and the more likely it is you have an AGN in the galaxy. Then plotted on the x-axis is the relative strength of the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon, or PAH, feature at 7.7 microns. And this is known to be relatively weak in AGN-dominated systems, but is seen to be very strong in nearby starbursts like M82. And so this is what the data show, where the galaxies lie in this plot. And this is just a very simple model where you mix up contributions from an AGN and a starburst. And down here, you're 100% starburst dominated, and up here, you're 100% AGN dominated. And you see it fits moderately well through the data points. So on average, these systems, most of them are dominated by star formation. There are perhaps 20 to 30% that are predominantly powered by an AGN. Now, that doesn't mean that there isn't always an AGN in these systems. It's just it's not the dominant source of the energy. And then I've highlighted here in blue and red a few of the galaxies that are actually from our sample. And so all of the galaxies except ARP 220, for which I haven't reprocessed the data that someone else took with the SMA, are included in what I'm discussing today. And so you see we have galaxies here that kind of span in the range where, you know, you would expect some significant AGN and starburst contribution. Okay, and so another reason to be interested in these galaxies, just besides the fact that they're the most intense starburst regions in the local universe, is that they can hopefully give us some understanding of what's going on in galaxies at very high redshifts. And the ultraluminous infrared galaxies are often used as the closest local counterpart to try to understand the submillimeter galaxies, which are typically at redshifts of 2 to 3, we think. And so these figures, this basically shows you an IRAM Plateau de Bure image of one of these high redshift galaxies showing two components there. This is one of the early, but a very nice picture. This is a SCUBA map in contours, so 15 arc second resolution, but showing you, you know, some of the galaxies that are picked up in this region. So these submillimeter galaxies are a very significant population of galaxies in the early universe. And I call them Ullrichs on steroids because they're significantly more luminous than the local Ullrichs. We really don't have anything in our local universe that gets up to the luminosities approaching 10 to the 13 that we deduce for these high redshift galaxies. So we do what we can and look at the nearby counterparts that get up there as high as we can. Okay, so our legacy project with the SMA was to do observe a sample of 14 luminous and ultraluminous infrared galaxies. We selected the galaxies to all lie within 200 megaparsecs. And the reason for this distance limit is it allows us to get reasonable spatial resolution with the SMA without having to go to their extremely long baseline configuration. And so we typically have a resolution of about a kiloparsec in our galaxy. Some are a bit better, a couple are a bit worse. Far infrared luminosities, we went down to a cutoff of 11.4 in the log of the far infrared, well down into the luminous infrared galaxy regime. I should say that ultraluminous infrared galaxies are ones above 10 to the 12th solar luminosities, and luminous are above 10 to the 11th. Part of the reason we went down this low in luminosity was so that we could probe galaxies along a range of along the merger sequence, basically. We wanted to look at some widely separated systems as well as the very compact systems, because you'll see one of our goals is to try to understand how the properties of the gas change as the merger progresses. So to get widely separated galaxies in our sample, we needed to go down to fairly low luminosities. Now, if you take these two criteria and you add, in addition, that they should be at reasonably northern declination, so you can look at them with the SMA, there are about, I think there are about 40 galaxies that meet this criteria. And so from those 40 galaxies, we selected 14, and the last criteria we used was that they all had been observed interferometrically previously in the CO ground state line of CO, the 1 to 0 line. And part of the reasons to do this is it gives you some confidence that there is something moderately compact there that the SMA will be able to see. Some of them, they weren't great data. There were some that were sort of early OVRO data with 8 arc second resolution, but at least there was something. Okay, so this just gives you a sort of overview snapshot. These are images from the Digital Sky Survey of 12 of the galaxies in our sample. A couple of them aren't shown. The dashed line is the field of view of the SMA in the CO 3 to 2 line and 850 microns continuum. And they're organized from the most infrared luminous over there to the least infrared luminous down here. And so you can...
Excuse me, Professor, if that's the field of view, what's the resolution?
So the field of view here is about 30 arc seconds, and our resolution is typically 1 to 2 arc seconds. Yeah. Yeah, we tailored our resolution so that the things that were further away, we did at 1 arc second. The things that were closer, we did at 2. And so we ended up with a moderately normal, moderately similar resolution on all galaxies, despite differences in distance. Okay. So even in the sky survey images, you can see the signs of the interaction in many cases, the tidal tails and so on. And there are some very compact galaxies, and then there are some, you know, where you can see the two separated components and so on. Okay, so we had 5 main science goals of our survey, and I'm not going to talk about all of them today. Particularly, we haven't worked on all of them yet. So the things I'm going to talk about are highlighted in blue through those 5 points. I'm going to talk a little bit about the distribution and kinematics of the gas. I'm going to talk about a little bit about the spatial distribution of the dust. One of the neat things about this survey is we've got the first kiloparsec scale images of dust continuum emission in any of these galaxies. All the other work on dust in these galaxies has been a global luminosity done with something like SCUBA. And then I'm going to compare the properties of the gas in our local sample with the high redshift sources, kind of a preliminary comparison. The SMA is located on Mauna Kea. It has 8 telescopes. I think most of our observations were taken typically with 7 because often one is out for repair or so. And as I said, our resolution ranges from 1 to 2 arc seconds, and most of the data were taken in a single nightly track. So there's about 5 or 6 hours integration on source. We have very nice data for most of the galaxies in this sample. So I'm going to show you a few figures here which are focusing on the 5 of the 6 most luminous galaxies in our sample, which lie at approximately the same distance. They're all at more or less 180 megaparsecs. And so it allows you to sort of look at a mini sample and get a little feel for the survey. So these are... 5 of the galaxies, you see many of them have very nice compact CO emission in the center. ARP 55 is the exception. It's one of the galaxies in our sample where the components are fairly widely separated, but we do, in fact, pick up emission in both the components. These are overlaid on HST I-band images, and I should say you don't get excited about the exact centering of the coordinates of the contours on the optical. It's very crudely done. HST coordinates are not accurate enough without doing extra work to overlay the SMA images on them.
Well, Christine, before you put away the 2 Macquarie galaxies,
yep.
There is stuff outside. Is it green or...
No, I think... With 14 galaxies, I don't always remember the details, but I'm fairly confident this is a side lobe. One of the things that happens when you're working with the data is you generally clean down to like a 1 or 2 sigma cutoff in velocity space, but then when you sum it up to look at the integrated intensity map, the side lobes can come up too. So, I mean, you can probably make a cleaner map by summing things first and then cleaning, but generally people, you know, don't bother to do that extra step. Yeah, no, I don't think that stuff out there isn't real. There. I'll show you some, if you're interested in blobs in the outside, I can show you some data later that has blobs in the outside. Okay, these are the velocity fields for the same 5 galaxies, and they're all plotted on the same color scale so that you can see the range of variation. Markarian 231 is one of the galaxies in our sample that's known to contain an AGN, and the velocity field shows very little rotation. We're essentially looking right down onto the disk, and so that's why we can see the AGN as you're looking right into the center. In comparison, this one's one of my favorites, UGC 5101, which is just rotating like crazy and is seen almost edge-on. But we have nice velocity fields in a lot of these galaxies that we should be able to do some interesting analysis with, the dynamics. Now, this is the really new stuff. In addition to just imaging the CO3 to 2, this is the dust continuum detected in these five galaxies. And they're contoured at, again, the same contour steps so that you can compare the relative strengths. They are all detected at 4 sigma or better. So just because there's one contour here doesn't mean it's not well detected. Markarian 231 has a significant amount of radio emission sneaking in, either non-thermal or thermal free-free emission. And so that flux needs to come down by about a factor of 25% or so to see the pure dust emission. But all the rest of these, what you're seeing here is thermal emission from cool dust. And so what some of the stuff that I'm going to show you later on is taking the continuum emission in basically the central resolution element, the central beam, and measuring the gas to dust ratio in that central beam, measuring the gas surface density in that central beam, sometime in the central area if it's resolved. Many of these sources, even in CO, are there. Some of them are resolved, but some of them are not. You know, they're really very compact emission inside sort of a kiloparsec or so. Okay, so here's an example, just moving down a little bit in luminosity, of one of the galaxies in our data set that is very extended. So this is VV114. I think it's at about 80 megaparsecs or so. This is an interesting galaxy because as you move to higher frequencies, you move up the rotational ladder of CO, you start to see this peak here in the middle shows up, which doesn't really show up in the CO1 to 0 maps. And so I think what we have here is the nucleus of one galaxy, the nucleus of the other galaxy, and already a collection of gas in the center where things are starting to accumulate. You can see this very complicated messed up velocity field here. The dashed lines are negative and the positive are the solid lines. This is not real. This is not real. These are, again, side lobes of the data. Part of the reason we can be confident they're side lobes is we also have CO2 to 1 data, and those features shift out as they would if they're proportional to your wavelength. So, but this is real, and I didn't put the CO2 to 1 data in, but in CO2 to 1, you really see a nice, you got better, so we have better sensitivity. You see a nice extension of material through there. So in our sample of 14 galaxies, 5 out of the 14 show 2 or more components. And in a couple of those cases, you already knew because they were, you know, two galaxies very far apart. But in some of them, you know, it's not so obvious, VV114 being one of them. Okay. So now I'm going to go through some numbers with you, mostly things that I just calculated in the last couple of days. And so I wanted to put this caveat in because I wasn't sure if the slides were going to go on the web or anything. I've just done these calculations literally yesterday and this morning, so there may be errors in them. I've checked them. I've done my best. But particularly things like the averages or the scaling is wrong. So if we find any errors, maybe I'll fix them before I put it on. Basically, we've completed the basic data reduction and all the basic measurements, but it's working on the derived quantities that I'm still doing. We're aiming to get the paper on these results submitted in the next 2 months. Okay. So of all the numbers I'm going to show here, this is the one I'm most confident about because I had worked on this quite a lot a year ago, and I've only had to adjust it slightly for some new data. So the gas-to-dust mass ratio. So we've looked at the gas-to-dust mass ratio in the central beam for every galaxy in our sample. And for the ones that have two components, we can do the two components separately if they're both detected. The reason we only look in the central beam is that if we use the global flux detected, we get very wildly varying gas-to-dust ratios. And what is going on is that given the SMA's bandwidth and sensitivity, we're much more sensitive per unit mass of stuff in CO than we are in the dust continuum. And you can do that calculation and say, okay, how you know, given this CO and a normal gas-to-dust ratio, how bright would you expect the continuum to be? And it's below our detection limit when you get out into the extended region. So we think at the peak, we're probably not being biased by that too much. But when you go out in the extended regions, you are. So that's why we focus on the peak. We calculate the dust mass using fairly standard assumptions, that value of the dust emissivity at 880 microns kappa comes from, I'm forgetting the name of the reference, but I was just looking at it last week. basically theoretical models for what you'd expect the emissivity to be in kind of a moderately dense medium, sort of a few hundred. Yeah, people should just jump in if they have questions, because I may not see your hand.
Does opacity depend on the dust temperature? And have you checked that the dust is optically thin?
Okay, so we have not made the opacity depend on the dust temperature. We have, these dust temperatures are derived from modified blackbody fits to publish data between 60 microns and 1 millimeter. And Andrew Baker has done that just in the last few weeks, actually. And they're all very good fits with betas of typically about 1.5, you know, some variation around that. And so that model seems to be pretty good. Now, that is a global value that we then have to apply to our central region. But there's nothing else we can do at the moment because there is no 1 arc second 60 micron images of these galaxies. To get down to 1 or 2 arc seconds, you've got to get all the way out to Spitzer at 3 microns.
But it is self-consistently.
It's self-consistently optically thin on the global scale, whether that's true in the center. I haven't gone back, I guess. I could go back from the dust masses from this and check whether you'd expect that to be optically thin. And that's a good idea, something I should do.
Yeah, well, I thought Dunn and Eels had shown that you get much better fits for 2 temperature components.
Sorry, who?
Dunn and Eels.
Yes. That is typically, their surveys go to much lower, go down into much more normal galaxies as well.
Well, really, and physically what's going on is that there's a whole continuum of temperature.
Yes.
So the work I've done with Sukhanya Chakrabarty, we actually have, you know, calculated,
yeah,
temperature distribution.
Yeah.
But, and so our results tend to be consistent with those of Dunn and Eels. It turns out all you need is just the 2 temperatures, you're already most of the way toward having a continuum. But,
right.
And there are factors of 2 difference from when you try to use a single temperature.
Right. Well, Andrew sent me these fits that he did. And for some of our galaxies, there's only 3 data points. You know, there's surprisingly little data on some galaxies. Then there's stuff like IRAS 17208, which must have, you know, 15 measurements. They're all well, 17208, for example, is really well fit by a single temperature beta equals about 1.5 model, where we allowed beta to vary in addition to the temperature. So, well,
that is, if you try to think about it, it's impossible.
No, that's right. Physically, it's impossible that it will be at 1 temperature.
But if you put in the physically correct thing, then you will get an equally.
But why should it be 2 temperatures?
No, you have a continuum of temperature.
Yeah.
We found that if you put in the whole power law distribution of temperatures that you calculate self-consistently,
yeah,
our results for the mass of dust were similar to those that Dunn and Eels got.
Okay, yeah. Well, the Dunn and Eels stuff, they have they had data points at 450 microns, which can be critical. But I think you have to be a little bit careful with that because, you know, you look at fitting, they were generally fitting 4 data points with a 2 temperature component. And the reason they could do that was, I think, they fixed beta, because otherwise you've got too many free parameters for your 4 data points. No, absolutely. Physically, everything's not at a single temperature.
Right.
There's no,
also,
there's no
that's
way.
That's another advantage of their approach, because I thought they were able to show that beta was then 2, or comparable to 2, which is what you expect based on the.
Yeah. No, I was. I was I think I was looking at the data recently. The other people who've done this type of, you know, power law of temperatures or heating thing is the Dale and Helu models and so on. And actually, I have a student who's working on some data for nearby normal galaxies. And he has, and a lot of them are in the SINGS survey, so he has a good 850 and 450 micron data to add to SINGS. And he's been fitting them. He's fit it with a modified single-temperature blackbody, and then he's also been fitting it with the Dale and Helu model. And we haven't quite finished doing that, so I can't tell you how well they compare. I think there was a factor of 2 difference between them on average so far, and I don't remember which way it went. Yeah.
Will you be telling us what temperatures you assume for the dust?
I wasn't going to tell you here, but I have the numbers in a paper. They're typically, I just happened to be looking at something this morning, and one of them, the top of the list was about 40 Kelvin.
That was the top?
The most luminous galaxy, the first one on my list. So 17208 was 40 Kelvin. And I think they may have gone up, one of them may have gone up as high as 60, and probably some go down as low as 30. They're moderately warm, actually, for a single temperature fit. I mean, if you did the same thing, you know, in the Milky Way or the stuff my student's doing, you get cooler temperatures. So, I mean, the you know, having some global mean temperature that's not a bad representation of your range of temperatures might work better in these galaxies because you've got a global starburst going on. I don't know.
Also, that relation between mass and luminosity, that must assume a temperature for the CO. Is it the Downs and Solomon use about the same temperatures as UK?
Right. So this is this relation, now to come to the next can of worms, this is a pretty much a standard CO to H2 conversion factor kind of argument, okay? But we're not using the galactic value. We're using something that's about one-fifth of the galactic value. And that value, which is 0.8, it was what Downs and Solomon determined in their big study of Ullrich's with IREM about 10 years ago. And it didn't assume a temperature, as I recall. It was
as long as it's the same temperature. It would scale with temperature.
Well, a number of the galaxies are in common between the two samples, yeah. The other variable is we're working with CO3 to 2, so we have to know this ratio, and that's not. I mean, I think a lot of these mass numbers are uncertain by a factor of 2 at least, and there's systematically, and there's no real way to get around that. Okay, anyway, taking all those uncertainties into account, we get a gas-to-dust ratio in the end that's actually surprisingly comparable to the gas-to-dust ratio in the Milky Way, which might be a little unexpected given the intense star formation in these galaxies, and there's probably shocks, and there's all kinds of stuff going on. Now, we are still looking only on a kiloparsec scale, so maybe that's why, you know, the fine details of places where dust is destroyed and so on are kind of lost in the wash. The good thing about this, I think, is that what it means is that you can actually take fairly standard assumptions about the interstellar medium in a normal galaxy, particularly the dust, and try to estimate how much dust mass or gas is in a galaxy, perhaps even at high redshift, and not be very far off. It's not like we got a value of 10 or 1,000. And so what I interpret this as saying is that the gas is, and the dust in particular, is actually fairly robust even in these regions of intense star formation, maybe because it's shielded in colder clumps, or something like that. But the good thing about this is you could take a measurement of flux at long wavelengths at high redshift and make a reasonable first guess at how much dust was there and hence how much gas mass was there.
May I ask another question? So you say the standard deviation is 159.
Yeah.
The error in the quote is 30.
This is the error in the mean. So there's another, I have 14 or 15 nuclei in this measurement, so there's another square root of 14. Yeah, that's why I put both numbers there. If they were all consistent with a single constant gas-to-dust ratio, this is the uncertainty. What we don't know, of course, is the variations may be real variations, in which case this doesn't make much sense. So that's why I put both numbers in. Okay, so this is, I think, what may be interesting to some people, the gas surface densities, because particularly when you work on galaxies, gas surface density seems to be linked to star formation. So there are very high gas surface densities in these galaxies, and some of this has been known for a while from work that Downs and Solomon have done, work that Nick Scoville's done. But the difference of what we're doing here is we're working with the higher JCO, so we're really tracing preferentially warmer, denser gas than you would if you're working with a CO1 to 0 line. And so we have gas surface densities ranging from about 10 to the 3 to 10 to the 4 solar masses per parsec squared. If you're not comfortable with those units, I've provided hopefully accurate these numbers should be accurate. I think these translations are correct. So in terms of H2 per centimeter squared, you're at 6 times 10 to the 22 to 6 times 10 to the 23. In terms of visual extinction, you're at 70 to 700 magnitudes. So hence my point at the beginning about needing mid-infrared to be able to see in what's going on. Another thing that's interesting is the average volume density. And so I've just done this very crudely in the last couple of days, taking the peak surface density and dividing it by radius to get an estimate of the volume density. So this is a very rough number. But this volume density at the peak ranges from 1 to 15 solar masses per parsec cubed. This is a volume density of hydrogen of 20 to 300. So this is much lower than your star-forming core that's going to form a single star in Orion or a Fucus. But it's interesting, I think, it's very close to the average volume density of a giant molecular cloud, depending on exactly how big your cloud is.
Is the spherical average
This is just a spherical sort of, well, the surf, yeah, yeah. So the interesting thing is that here you've got a region, the average volume density is similar to a giant molecular cloud, but of course the volume over which that density exists is much larger, because we're talking about a kiloparsec volume as opposed to a 10 to 100 parsec volume.
Do you know what the scale height is?
Well, I don't. So as Chris said, it's a lower limit. So, you know, the density could be quite a bit higher. I mean, realistically speaking, I mean, you could probably do an estimate, kind of an average estimate, if I took some of our galaxies seem to be edge-on, so then we're getting a radius and maybe the scale height directly, and I could do density that way. And then there's things like Markarian 231, which are face-on, and so I could take an estimate of the scale height from the edge-on ones and apply it to the face-on ones. I haven't done anything like that. This is very simple. That's right. It's the entire molecular gas of our galaxy inside a kiloparsec. Yeah. So it's very different from, you know, the type of things we're often talking about and we're talking about yesterday, typically.
The first thing I did on seeing these numbers is calculate the thermal James mass, in particular if it's at the dust temperature.
Mm-hmm.
Because last week, and maybe this afternoon, we'll be talking about a recent model where during a collapse, the gas temperature locks in with the dust temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And then at that density, you get a thermal James mass.
Yeah.
So there's some interest in seeing whether, say, the turnover point in the IMF is constant or shifts.
Mm-hmm.
So if we do that here, if we assume the temperature is some 40 degrees, that's three times local.
Yeah.
And if we assume that the pressure is scaling with the square of the column density here,
mm-hmm.
Okay, so now the James mass is temperature squared over square root of pressure. So that is up by a factor of 10 in the numerator. But your column densities are a factor of 100.
Mm-hmm.
So the square root of pressure is a factor of 100. So that means the thermal James mass at this locked-in dust temperature is 1/10 what it is locally. So if we think of the turnover in the IMF as being a couple tenths of a solar mass in the solar neighborhood.
Yeah.
It'd be a couple hundredths of a solar mass here.
Yeah, I didn't quite follow all through your numbers,
well,
but
just,
if they're right, yeah.
Pretty standard. The
yeah.
point is the temperature's not going up nearly as fast as the pressure. Or
yeah.
as the square root.
Yeah.
Temperature squared is not going up as fast as the square root of pressure.
Yeah.
And this is a strong constraint. You see this a lot in the starburst regions. People have known these kinds of numbers for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then dense superstar clusters and other things. You see this a lot. In places where we think the IMF looks somewhat normal, because the, you know, metallicities are normal, the mass lights are somewhat normal, all the models we have now that people are playing with now don't give you a constant turnover.
Mm-hmm.
They vary by factors of 10 up and down from where we are locally.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is why.
So this is the temperature during the starburst, right?
So you're still warm stars.
I mean, if it's true that star formation, starbursts don't form the bulk of the stellar matter, what we heard, you know, last talk at the conference.
Well, right here they sure are. So the IMF here should be very different than our own, and a lot of regions, elliptical galaxies form like this.
Yeah, but aren't starbursts? Yeah, the starbursts are the result of a merger in most cases, and it's an episodic period of the full star formation history of the galaxy, right? And it's a small fraction of the total star formation history in the galaxy.
This is forming an enormous number of stars. This will end up like elliptical galaxies. And elliptical galaxies don't have that unusual
IMF. So you mean that you can estimate the IMF in this object of the current star formation?
If I apply, say, Larson's models and some of the simulations you've done.
Yes.
I would predict an IMF.
How do you know the IMF of these stars that are forming now?
I'm just scaling the.
How would you know observationally what
you
the
can't.
IMF is?
You don't. Looking
so the answer
now,
is that you don't know if there is a problem or not.
Well, you do know what the end results of these look like, namely elliptical galaxies.
The end result is due only in small fraction to the starburst, because the starburst is only 10% or less of the total star formation history in the galaxy.
I wonder.
I don't think that's always true.
What would be the mass of stars coming out of this? Turn all this, it's all the gas is turning into stars.
Well, that's the last talk of the conference. I mean, the last Hernquist work shows that essentially with the student, the starbursts don't give a large contribution to the total mass in stars that you get at the end of the. Do you remember the last talk at the conference, right?
Phil Hopkins.
Phil Hopkins. what he said, his work with Lars, they have shown that essentially, even if mergers are very, very, that the contribution to the total star formation rate of a galaxy through merging is not a major contribution.
But back in the old days when the IRAS first flew, there was a claim that if you actually look at the luminosity coming out of one class of these, they're just so bright that you needed more high-mass stars and fewer low-mass stars to understand just the sheer bolometric luminosity of these regions. I don't know if that's still a whole lot.
I don't know.
Oh, I know. I know it goes the wrong way. But I'm just asking.
But LIGHT-ARC-GEN showed that that was not consistent.
Independent of what happened 20 years ago, what's the current status on that question? Namely, how bright are these? What's the equivalent mass to luminosity ratio of these?
Yeah, I
must have some constraint.
No, I'm sure there are constraints. I haven't looked at that.
That a year ago.
Make a comment.
What's the answer, Bruce?
No evident change except for a handful of clusters.
No what?
No obvious change in the IMF by any measure except for three or four superstar clusters.
Well, there is no evidence of the heavy IMF.
Yeah.
But there's no evidence that there's a lack of large stars also? Is that the claim?
There is evidence for a lack of it, yes. It is consistent with Salpeter for starburst regions in general, except for a few superstar clusters where it looks flattened or shifted. And those Mark Eilis is questioning for good reason, because they look under-laxed.
But you cannot constrain the turnover.
Well, I think you can, because if it keeps on going, then you're underestimating the total mass of stars by a factor of 10.
But the galaxy is not in starburst space for most of the star formation history. There's no way.
No, but I'm saying if you make 10 times more mass in stars than you think, because if it keeps on going with Salpeter, that means that then there's 10 times more mass.
And the star formation rate is that much higher.
But this constraint he's talking about are not based on global mass luminosity. They're based on...
But may I make a comment? I would like to quote you. The comment you made after his talk yesterday. Maybe we should not base too much of these discussions on these extremely simplified models. Because as you point out yourself, I mean, the temperature you give is just a global average. It may vary widely from regions to regions. And we do not know whether the bulk of the star formation in these 1 kiloparsec across is really taking place at these temperatures. Maybe it takes place at much higher temperatures, and then you get more than normal IMF.
Fair enough.
And I think all this is, in a sense, like, I don't know, the one-eyed or the blind.
Well, no, if you actually make models where you allow for continuous variation, then these star models are consistent with 1/r² distribution of density, which means most of the mass is on the outside, and so then the temperature would be somewhat
Better be higher, because my problem is the temperature here is too low.
No, I agree.
So you want star forming regions to be 120 Kelvin.
But they're not. Most of the mass is out there.
We did this study with Marcus Palm's equation of state. We quoted values from, say, Frank Israel and others, and they find much higher temperatures, of order of 100 Kelvin. And, I mean, I think it very much depends where you look, how you how you analyze
it. See, Christine, this is why these regions are so useful as extreme cases.
Yeah.
To use standard models in the extreme, because everywhere locally people get complete agreement because they assume it all.
This is not a lot of range.
But and also the Kennicott relations, which you may talk about as well. These extreme cases are valuable.
Okay, so moving on, we talked a little bit about some of the things related to this. This is just some quick numbers. This is not anything new to my survey, but I thought to put, things in context, you know, what are the star formation rates and efficiencies in these regions? And here I'm using the very old observer's definition of an efficiency, which is solar luminosities per solar mass, LIR over MH2, which is really an inverse time scale. It's not an efficiency the way you might calculate something like Ophiuchus. These ratios range from 30 to 600 in the galaxies in our sample. My memory is giant molecular clouds in the Milky Way. The value is maybe 3 or 4, so that's much higher. Kennicott's review paper about 10 years ago gave a bunch of different formula that you could use to calculate star formation rates, assuming normal IMFs and so on. If you take the formula for far-infrared luminosity and plug in the luminosities of the galaxies in our sample, you get star formation rates of 50 to 450 solar masses per year. So they are very intense starbursts, even if there's a factor two uncertainty in that. If you turn this around into a gas depletion time, you get times of about 10 million to 200 million years. So it's certainly not going to last very long in this phase. Now, this is a very naive estimate. Obviously, not all the gas ends up in stars, so your fuel may last longer and so on. But this is just the very rough. If everything went into stars and nothing came out, what would you get? So very high star formation rates and efficiencies compared to normal galaxies or giant molecular clouds may be linked to the very high gas surface densities and densities. That would be my estimate. Okay, I don't know how I'm doing for time because I don't have a watch.
Right. Including the discussion, you have another 15 minutes.
Okay. So let me just quickly talk about the comparison of the galaxies. These galaxies were the high redshift galaxies. I don't know if that many people here are interested in high redshift galaxies, but I think this is very interesting. So I've done this comparison in two different ways. First time around, I took the four of the five galaxies for which I showed you the pictures earlier, dropped the one that was separated, looked at the compact luminous ones, and said, how do those compare to eight high redshift galaxies, which have been measured, the high redshift galaxies, in the CO3 to 2 line by Linda Tacconi, Reinhard Genzel, and various people. The reason it's nice to do this comparison now is that we're looking at exactly the same transition that was used at high redshift. So you get around a lot of the concerns about things like CO excitation and so on. You can really kind of compare apples and apples as best you can. Okay, so just looking at four galaxies from our sample versus eight high redshift galaxies, what do we see? Well, the high redshift galaxies are an order of magnitude more luminous in their CO3 to 2 line. That's not really new to our sample. There are single dish data for these local ULIRGs, and people knew that the high redshift ones were more luminous. The high redshift ones have somewhat broader lines by about perhaps 50%. Again, that's not really new from our sample, although it is nice to see that the very broad lines continue in when you look in the real center where all the action is. What really intrigued me when I did this estimate before I gave the first talk on this work was the diameters are quite a bit different between the high redshift galaxies and the local ones. The high redshift galaxies have an average diameter of about 5 kiloparsecs, and these four bright local galaxies have a diameter of about 600 parsecs. So the local ones look much more compact than the high redshift ones. Now, you might say, okay, well, the high redshift ones are more luminous, they're more massive, so they're more bigger, you know, fine, everything's fine. But what's interesting is if you say, what's the gas surface density that you would get from the size and the luminosity? And the answer is that the surface density would actually be maybe a factor of 10 lower in the high redshift galaxies, because they're a factor 10 brighter, but they're a factor of 10 bigger in size, and it's luminosity over size squared. That's interesting. Now, the caveat, though, speaking as an observer, these are all galaxies where they claim to have spatially resolved the emission in CO. It's all right on the hairy edge, in my opinion. You know, it's very hard. These are low signal-to-noise things. They're not hugely resolved, generally. And so it's possible that these high redshift diameters are an overestimate, and that when we get a more sensitive telescope like ALMA that can get higher resolution, you know, we will see that, no, they're not actually 5 kiloparsecs in size. They're 3 or something like that, or even lower.
Could the local ones be an underestimate because you resolved out some of the more tense?
Yes, they could be. Although in a couple of two of our galaxies in that four, the two Markarian galaxies, we've got all the flux in the SMA map. Yeah, no, so it does. There is room, and so that might bring the surface densities into better agreement. The high redshift ones could be unresolved doubles as well.
Uh-huh. Two classes, one that was about a factor of 10. I think those were the NTT ones. And then the other, the 7-millimeter ones, were, I think, very high surface density.
Yeah. Okay. So this is some new numbers. So that previous slide is something I worked through quite carefully last summer. Here I decided, well, what if we look at our entire sample, because I've got all the data now. you know, maybe I've biased my analysis by just picking, you know, four compact ones out of my sample. So if we look at our entire sample of 15 galaxies, we still see that the high redshift galaxies are an order of magnitude more luminous. No surprising. What's a little interesting to me is actually my average CO luminosity detected with the SMA. So there is other emission out there on wider scales. Didn't change very much when I went from my four very compact ones to my other ones. And I've now included a broader range of infrared luminosities. So my CO luminosity isn't changing very much in this sample as I include infrared fainter galaxies. I'm not sure what that means. I just found that out a couple hours ago. I would argue that you still have larger full-width half maximum diameters on average when you go to the entire sample. 9 of our galaxies out of 14 are a single component. And if you include the other ones that go fainter, they're up to maybe approaching a kiloparsec on average. The compact galaxies span the full range of infrared luminosity we've looked at. Our faintest galaxy is a single compact component. Our brightest galaxy is a single compact component. We have 5 galaxies that have 2 nuclei separated by anywhere from 4 kiloparsecs in the case of VV114 that I showed you, out to 36 kiloparsecs for one of our fairly widely separated pairs. These extended galaxies tend to be at the fainter end in far infrared luminosity. The brightest is ARP299, which is only a factor of 2 brighter in infrared than our cutoff. So there seems to be, there's probably some correlation there between separation and infrared luminosity, which again, you know, people can do from the optical.
I'm sorry, that meant that the higher separations were lower luminosities?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so that's basically where we are with our work so far. And I just wanted to show a couple of examples of the type of thing we hope to be able to do with the data over the next couple of years, going on to some of those additional science goals. So we have from the SMA, we have CO3 to 2, CO2 to 1, 13 CO2 to 1 data, and there's good CO1 to 0 data for most of the galaxies. In some cases, we may go back and see if we can get better images with KARMA. And so this is a nice set of line ratios that we can put into radiative transfer models to try to determine the physical conditions in the gas. And I think this will be very interesting because we can look for variations in the physical conditions with position in the galaxy. And particularly those galaxies with the multiple components are going to be really interesting. This is the antennae, NGC 4038-4039, which is not in our sample because it had already been done with the SMA. And these two images compare SMA CO3 to 2 in red with CO1 to 0 data that I published about 5 years ago. And then over here, you have the line ratio color-coded overlaid on an IRAC 8-micron image. And one of the interesting things is we see variations in the line ratio with position and with velocity. And so we may be able to identify different regions that appear superimposed on the basis of changes in the line ratio. But anyway, physical properties such as density, temperature, Collin density from something more than just your CO to H2 conversion factor would be nice. Once we have that, a kind of an ultimate goal of our survey, which is going to have to wait until all the analysis is done, is to take our data and compare them to numerical simulations of galaxy mergers, both to see what they can tell us about figuring out what age stage of the merger the different galaxies are in and putting them together in a merger sequence, and also to feed back in the physical properties that we've measured into the models. So observationally, if we can put together a merger sequence, we can maybe see how the physical properties of the gas change as a merger progresses, which would be very interesting. And then you can also help fully improve the models by feeding back in, you know, what we know about the properties of the gas. So T.J. Cox from CFA is a theorist who's one of the people on our team, and he's working with Lars Hernquist, I guess, on some very large number of simulations that hopefully we can tap into at some point. And so that's basically my conclusions.
Okay. Thank you very much. So, more questions?
So, given the star formation rate, is there about as much? Is the gas to dust ratio about 1:1?
So you're thinking dust produced by the stars that are forming?
Yeah.
I haven't really thought about that. I'm not actually really sure how you address that, because I thought a lot of the dust was formed in the later stages of the stars, kind of like stars like our sun when they reach an AGB phase, and that'll be so much later than this starburst that's happening right now.
Well, there are multiple sources, aren't there? There are AGB winds, but also supernova.
Yeah. I thought observationally the supernova dust was a little uncertain, but the Dunn paper, yeah.
Primordial star formers love it, but there's no, not much else.
Yeah.
So I think the dust modulus in Heidelberg, Guy, for instance, would say it's a bit fishy, and most of the dust in the Milky Way would be made by AGB stars.
Yeah.
Okay, Chris, I had a question, which is one in the models that I was describing that I'm doing with Chakrabarty, we assume that the density distribution goes out to very large distances.
Uh-huh.
So maybe 10 kiloparsecs. My question is, what is there evidence? Well, of course, when the temperature keeps on going down, it basically emerges like the CMB. So the question is, when you're quoting these sizes, is there any evidence that things actually stop there, or is it just that you lose sensitivity?
Well, we have. So in a number of our galaxies, we're missing flux. The interferometers, I don't know anyone who doesn't know interferometers, they filter out large spatial scales. So it's like looking at a mountain range, chopping off and just seeing where the peaks are and not the underlying base. But there are some galaxies where we detect everything. Markarian 231, Markarian 273. Well, the single dish beam is a 15 arc second beam, typically. It's JCMT data. And then we detect everything and see a full width half maximum of an arc second. Probably the full extent, I mean, I actually showed you those two Markarian galaxies quickly in one of my slides, and my field of view was 4 arc seconds. And so it probably wasn't any more than 2 arc seconds, which at those distances is, I'm going to say, 2 to 4 kiloparsecs, more or less.
In principle, there could be stuff even out beyond that.
Well, there's H1 beyond that,
yeah.
For sure. Sure.
Yeah, so the CO, I guess, would not. We were more interested in the dust. If the gas and the dust keep on going out in some distribution, then when.
Yeah. Okay, well, as far as dust goes, we're really sensitivity limited. It's one of the actually really interesting things technically about this survey is that for the first time, because we have these high resolution dust measurements, we're actually detecting missing flux in the continuum, I think, with some degree of confidence, which generally correlates with the missing flux in CO. So I think what we're seeing is this extended gas and dust in these systems, and we're missing it in both. But if you start to integrate up the CO over large areas, you run into this problem where, you're probably detecting more of the low surface brightness stuff than you would be in the continuum.
Were there any other questions?
Is the metallicity known for those galaxies?
Oh, very good question. One of my co-authors was pointing out to me that there's a recent paper on AstroPH with metallicity measurements for a bunch of nearby Eulers. I think it's Sylvain Veilleux, Andrew Baker's a co-author, and my memory, I just looked at the title, but I haven't read it. My memory is he said they're a bit subsolar. Yeah, but not hugely. I would guess factor 2. They're not down at the SMC or anything like that. Yeah.
Just to point out that if these high Z galaxies are in fact a factor of 10 bigger, then the characteristic thermal gene mass would end up being the same as this. Curious. And also, I mean, you're just about to say this, that the high redshift interaction should be much brighter and should have much more star formation, because these massive galaxies, by downsizing, haven't lost their gas yet. They're still massive,
yeah.
And they're still gas rich.
Yeah.
So when they collide, they make a big bang.
Yeah. No, it's no surprising that they're very luminous out there.
Locally, those big galaxies are all rimmed in.
Yeah.
They collide, they don't do much.
Yeah.
Okay, let's thank Chris again. So now go from